this time, cajoled him into leaking the whole inspection report to me. Running 121 pages long, the document was as damning as one could expect. For one thing, it proved that Holmes had lied at the journal's tech conference the previous fall. The proprietary devices Theranos had used in the lab were indeed called Edison, and the report showed it had used them for only 12 of the 250 tests on its menu. Every other test had been run on commercial analyzers. More important, the inspection report showed, citing the lab's own data, that the Edisons produced wildly erratic results. During 1 month, they had failed quality control checks nearly a third of the time. One of the blood tests run on the Edisons, a test to measure a hormone that affects testosterone levels, had failed quality control an astounding 87% of the time. Another test, to help detect prostate cancer, had failed 22% of its quality control checks. In comparison runs using the same blood samples, the Edisons had produced results that differed from those of conventional machines by as much as 146%. And just as Tyler Schultz had contended, the devices couldn't reproduce their own results. An Edison test to measure vitamin B12 had a coefficient of variation that ranged from 34 to 48%, far exceeding the 2 or 3% common for the test at most labs. As for the lab itself, it was a mess. The company had allowed unqualified personnel to handle patient samples, it had stored blood at the wrong temperatures, it had let reagents expire, and it had failed to inform patients of flawed test results, among many other lapses. Heather King tried to prevent us from publishing the report, but it was too late. We posted it on the journal's website, and the accompanying story quoted a laboratory expert who said its findings suggested the Edison's results were no better than guesswork. The coup de grace came a few days later, when we obtained a new letter CMS had sent to Theranos. It said the company had failed to correct 43 of the 45 deficiencies the inspectors had cited it for, and threatened to ban Holmes from the blood testing business for 2 years. As with the inspection report, Theranos was desperately trying to keep the letter from becoming public, but a news source had contacted me out of the blue and leaked it to me. When we reported news of the threatened ban, it was no longer possible for Holmes to downplay the gravity of the situation. She had to come out and say something, so she gave an interview to Maria Shriver on NBC's Today show, in which she professed to be devastated. But not enough, it seemed, to apologize to the patients she had put in harm's way. Watching her, I got the distinct impression that her display of contrition was an act. I still didn't sense any real remorse or empathy. After all, Theranos' employees, its investors, and its retail partner, Walgreens, had all learned of the inspection's findings and the threatened ban by reading the Wall Street Journal. If Holmes was sincere about making things right, why had she tried so hard to suppress their disclosure? In May 2016, I returned to the San Francisco Bay Area to try to find out what had happened to Tyler Schultz. It was almost exactly a year to the day since we'd met at the beer garden in Mountain View. Erica had told me Tyler was working on a research project with a nanotechnology professor at Stanford, so I drove my rental car to Palo Alto and searched for him in Stanford's School of Engineering. After asking around, I finally located him in a room in the Materials Science Building. Tyler wasn't surprised to see me. Erica had given me his real email address, and I'd written to him to let him know I was coming back through town. He'd been noncommittal about meeting with me. Now that I was there, though, he relented. We walked over to a nearby cafeteria to grab some lunch and slipped into easy banter. Tyler seemed in good spirits. He told me he was part of a small group of researchers at Stanford that had teamed up with a Canadian company to compete in the multi-million dollar Qualcomm Tricorder X Prize competition. They were trying to build a portable device capable of diagnosing a dozen diseases from a person's blood, saliva, and vital signs. When our conversation turned to Theranos, his brows furrowed and he tensed up. He didn't want to discuss the subject in an open place within earshot of other people, he said. He suggested we walk back to the Materials Science Building. We found an empty classroom there and sat down. His relaxed demeanor in the cafeteria had given way to palpable anxiety. My lawyers forbade me from talking to you, but I can't keep this bottled up anymore, he said. I agreed to keep whatever he was about to tell me off the record and only to write about it in the future if he gave me his permission to do so. For the next 45 minutes, I listened dismayed as Tyler told me about the ambush at his grandfather's house and the months of legal threats he'd endured. Despite it all, he had never buckled. He had steadfastly refused to sign any document Boy Schiller had put to him. If not for his courage and the more than $400,000 his parents had spent on his attorneys, I might never have been able to get my first article published, I realized. I felt pangs of guilt for having put him through such an ordeal. The most heartbreaking part of it all was Tyler's estrangement from his grandfather. George Schultz had continued to side with Holmes in spite of everything my reporting had revealed. He and Tyler hadn't seen each other for the better part of a year, and they communicated only through lawyers. The previous December, the Schultzes had hosted a party at a penthouse apartment they owned in San Francisco to celebrate George's 95th birthday. Holmes had attended, but not Tyler. Tyler had heard through his parents that his grandfather continued to believe in the promise of Theranos. In a complete about-face, after years of intense secrecy, Holmes was going to unveil the inner workings of her technology at the American Association for Clinical Chemistry's annual meeting on August 1, 2016. George believed that her presentation would silence the doubters. Tyler didn't understand why he couldn't see through her lies. What would it take for him to finally accept the truth? As we parted, Tyler thanked me for doggedly pursuing the story. He pointed out that Theranos had consumed the past 4 years of his life, dating back to his summer internship at the company between his junior and senior years in college. I thanked him in turn for helping me get the story out and for withstanding the immense pressure under which he had been placed. Not long afterward, Theranos contacted Tyler's lawyers and told them it knew about our meeting. Since neither of us had told a soul about it, we deduced that Holmes was having one or both of us followed. Fortunately, Tyler didn't seem too worried about it. Next time, maybe I'll take a selfie with you and send it her way to save her the trouble of hiring PIs, he quipped in an email. I now suspected Theranos had had both of us under continuous surveillance for a year. And, more than likely, Erica Chung and Alan Beam, too. Holmes had told Maria Shriver on the Today Show that she took responsibility for the Newark lab's failings, but it was Balwani who suffered the consequences. Rather than take the fall herself, she sacrificed her boyfriend. She broke up with him and fired him. In a press release, Theranos dressed up his departure as a voluntary retirement. A week later, we reported that Theranos had voided tens of thousands of blood test results, including 2 years' worth of Edison tests, in an effort to come back into compliance and avoid the CMS ban. In other words, it had effectively admitted to the agency that not a single one of the blood tests run on its proprietary devices could be relied upon. Once again, Holmes had hoped to keep the voided tests secret, but I found out about them from my new source, the one who had leaked to me CMS's letter threatening to ban Holmes from the lab industry. In Chicago, executives at Walgreens were astonished to learn of the scale of the test voidings. The pharmacy chain had been trying to get answers from Theranos about the impact on its customers for months. On June 12, 2016, it terminated the company's partnership and shut down all the wellness centers located in its stores. In another crippling blow, CMS followed through on its threat to ban Holmes and her company from the lab business in early July. More ominously, Theranos was now the subject of a criminal investigation by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco, and of a parallel civil probe by the Securities and Exchange Commission. In spite of all these setbacks, Holmes felt she still had one card to play to turn public opinion around. Wow the world with a display of her technology. On a muggy summer day at the beginning of August, more than 2,500 people crowded into the grand ballroom of the Pennsylvania Convention Center in Philadelphia. Most were laboratory scientists who had come to hear Holmes speak at the annual meeting of the AACC. Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones was playing on the public announcement system, a choice of music that didn't seem like a coincidence. The invitation the association had extended to Holmes was highly controversial among its members. Some had argued forcefully that it should be withdrawn, given the events of recent months. But the association's leadership had seen a chance to generate publicity and buzz for the normally staid scientific conference. It was proven right in that regard. Several dozen journalists had made the trek to Philadelphia to watch the spectacle. After a few introductory remarks from AACC President Patricia Jones, Holmes stepped up to the lectern. She wore a white blouse under a dark jacket. Gone was the black turtleneck, which had become an object of ridicule since the previous fall. What followed wasn't so much a scientific presentation as it was a new product exhibit. Over the next hour, Holmes proceeded to unveil the machine that had been but a malfunctioning prototype when Theranos had gone live with its blood tests nearly 3 years earlier, the Mini-Lab. Theranos's engineers and chemists had improved the device since that early model, but the company still hadn't conducted a full clinical study to prove that it worked reliably across a wide range of assays using blood pricked from fingertips. While Holmes's presentation included some data, much of it involved venous blood drawn from the arm. The little finger stick data it contained covered only 11 blood tests and wasn't independently verified or peer-reviewed. CMS had just banned Holmes from running clinical laboratories, but no matter. She explained that the mini-lab connected wirelessly to servers at Theranos headquarters and could be deployed directly in patients' homes, doctors' offices, or hospitals, doing away with the need for a central lab. In effect, she was pirouetting back to her original vision of portable blood testing machines operated remotely through Wi-Fi or cellular networks. Of course, after everything that had happened, commercializing such a system without the FDA's approval was out of the question. And putting together the thorough studies the agency would want to see would take years. That was why she had tried to bypass the FDA in the first place. The odds that Holmes could pull off this latest Houdini act while under criminal investigation were very long. But watching her confidently walk the audience through her sleek slideshow helped crystallize for me how she'd gotten this far. She was an amazing saleswoman. She never once stumbled or lost her train of thought. She wielded both engineering and laboratory lingo effortlessly, and she showed seemingly heartfelt emotion when she spoke of sparing babies in the NICU from blood transfusions. Like her idol Steve Jobs, she emitted a reality distortion field that forced people to momentarily suspend disbelief. The spell was broken, however, during the question and answer session, when Stephen Master, an associate professor of pathology at Weill Cornell Medical Center in New York, and one of three panelists invited on stage to ask Holmes questions, pointed out that the mini-lab's capabilities fell far short of the original claims she had made. His comment drew a burst of applause from the audience. Reverting to the chastened persona from her Today Show interview, Holmes acknowledged that Theranos had a lot of work to do, as she put it, to engage with the laboratory community. But she stopped short again of apologizing or admitting fault. When Dennis Low, a pathology professor at the Chinese University of Hong Kong, later asked her how the mini-lab differed from the technology the company had used in its laboratory on patient samples, she dodged the question. It was a giant issue to sidestep, yet the hundreds of assembled pathologists remained civil and respectful, despite her evasiveness. There were no boos or catcalls. The decorum broke down only briefly when Holmes turned to leave the stage at the end of the Q&A.
"You hurt people," a voice yelled out from the dispersing crowd.
If Holmes had hoped to rehabilitate her image and change the media narrative by unveiling the mini-lab, that hope was dashed by the flurry of critical articles published in the wake of the event. A headline in Wired captured the reaction best. Theranos had a chance to clear its name. Instead, it tried to pivot. In an interview with the Financial Times, Jeffrey Baird, a professor of pathology at the University of Washington, said Holmes's presentation had included a comically small amount of data and had the feel of someone putting together a last-minute term paper late at night. Other lab experts were quick to note that none of the mini-lab's various components were novel. All Theranos had done was make them smaller and pack them into one box, they said. One of the mini-lab tests Holmes had showcased at the conference was for Zika, the mosquito-borne virus that had damaged the brains of thousands of newborns around the world. Theranos had applied to the FDA for emergency use authorization of the test, billing it as the first fingerstick blood test of its kind. But in another embarrassing setback, FDA inspectors soon discovered that the company had failed to include basic patient safeguards in its study, forcing it to withdraw the application. The possibility that Holmes might pull a rabbit out of her proverbial hat at the AACC meeting had kept Theranos' restless investors from launching a mutiny. After her appearance was panned and the Zika fiasco made headlines, one of them decided it had had enough. Partner Fund, the San Francisco hedge fund that had invested close to $100 million in the company in early 2014, sued Holmes, Balwani, and the company in Delaware's Court of Chancery, alleging that they had deceived it with a series of lies, material misstatements, and omissions. Another set of investors, led by the retired banker Robert Coleman, filed a separate lawsuit in federal court in San Francisco. It also alleged securities fraud and sought class action status. Most of the other investors opted against litigation, settling instead for a grant of extra shares in exchange for a promise not to sue. One notable exception was Rupert Murdoch. The media mogul sold his stock back to Theranos for $1, so he could claim a big tax write-off on his other earnings. With a fortune estimated at $12 billion, Murdoch could afford to lose more than $100 million on a bad investment. David Boyce and his law firm Boyce, Schiller & Flexner stopped doing legal work for Theranos after falling out with Holmes over how to handle the federal investigations. Another big law firm, WilmerHale, took their place. A month after Holmes's AACC appearance, Heather King returned to Boyce Schiller as a partner, based in its Palo Alto office. Boyce left the Theranos board a few months later. Walgreens, which had sunk a total of $140 million into Theranos, filed its own lawsuit against the company, accusing it of failing to meet the most basic quality standards and legal requirements of the company's contract. The fundamental premise of the party's contract, like any endeavor involving human health, was to help people and not to harm them, the drugstore chain wrote in its complaint. After initially attempting to appeal the CMS ban, Holmes resigned herself to the inevitable and closed the California lab as well as the company's second lab in Arizona, which had used only commercial analyzers. During an inspection of the Arizona facility days before it was shuttered, CMS found a multitude of problems there, too. Under a settlement with Arizona's Attorney General, Theranos subsequently agreed to pay $4.65 million into a state fund that reimbursed the 76,217 Arizonans who ordered blood tests from the company. The number of test results Theranos voided or corrected in California and Arizona eventually reached nearly 1 million. The harm done to patients from all those faulty tests is hard to determine. 10 patients have filed lawsuits alleging consumer fraud and medical battery. One of them alleges that Theranos's blood tests failed to detect his heart disease, leading him to suffer a preventable heart attack. The suits have been consolidated into a putative class action in federal court in Arizona. Whether the plaintiffs are able to prove injury in court remains to be seen. One thing is certain: the chances that people would have died from missed diagnoses or wrong medical treatments would have risen exponentially if the company had expanded its blood testing services to Walgreens' 8,134 other U.S. stores, as it was on the cusp of doing when Pathology Blog's Adam Clapper reached out to me. Epilogue. In the days after my first journal article, Holmes defiantly asserted that she would publish clinical data from her blood testing system to disprove my reporting. "Data is a powerful thing because it speaks for itself," she said on October 26, 2015, at a conference hosted by the Cleveland Clinic. 2 years and 3 months later, she finally delivered on that pledge. In January 2018, Theranos published a paper about the mini-lab in the peer-reviewed scientific journal Bioengineering and Translational Medicine. The paper described the device's components and inner workings and included some data purporting to show that it held its own when compared with FDA-approved machines. But there was one major catch. The blood Theranos had used in its study was drawn the old-fashioned way, with a needle in the arm. Holmes's original premise, fast and accurate test results from just a drop or two pricked from a finger, was nowhere to be found in the paper. A close read revealed other significant shortcomings. For one thing, the paper included data for only a few blood tests, and results for two of those tests, HDL cholesterol and LDL cholesterol, diverged from the FDA-approved machines by a margin that Theranos itself acknowledged exceeds recommended limits. The company also conceded that it had run the assays one at a time, belying Holmes's previous claim that her technology could do dozens of tests simultaneously on one tiny blood sample. Last but not least, the tests performed had required different configurations of the mini-lab because Theranos hadn't yet figured out how to fit all the components into one box. All of this was a far cry from the revolutionary breakthrough Holmes had touted when Theranos launched its tests in Walgreens stores in the fall of 2013. Holmes's name was listed among the paper's co-authors, but Balwani's was not. After their breakup and his departure from the company in the spring of 2016, Balwani seemed to have dropped off the face of the earth. Holmes had moved out of the 6,555-square-foot house he owned in Atherton, acquired for $9 million in 2013 through a limited liability company, and it wasn't clear if he continued to live there. For a time, there was speculation among former Theranos employees that he had fled the country to elude federal investigators. Those rumors were put to rest on the morning of March 6, 2017, when Tyler Schultz entered a conference room at the offices of Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher on Mission Street in San Francisco. Standing among the half-dozen lawyers present to take his deposition in the partner fund litigation was the familiar diminutive figure with the angry scowl who had terrorized Theranos employees. Balwani was a named defendant in the lawsuit, so his presence was unusual and seemed to have but one purpose: to intimidate the witness. If that was indeed the goal, it didn't work. Over the next 8.5 hours, Tyler focused on giving truthful answers to the questions he was asked and blocked out the silent presence of his irascible former boss at the other end of the conference table. 7 weeks later, Theranos settled the case for $43 million on the eve of Balwani's own deposition. Soon after, it settled the Walgreens lawsuit for more than $25 million. By late 2017, Theranos was running on fumes, having burned through most of the $900 million it raised from investors, much of it on legal expenses. Several rounds of layoffs had reduced the size of its workforce to fewer than 130 employees from a high of 800 in 2015. To save on rent, the company had moved all its remaining staff to the Newark facility across San Francisco Bay. The specter of a bankruptcy filing loomed. But a few days before Christmas, Holmes announced that she had secured a $100 million loan from a private equity firm. The financial lifeline came with strict conditions. The loan was collateralized by Theranos' patent portfolio, and the company would have to meet certain product and operational milestones to get the money. Less than 3 months later, the walls began closing in again. On March 14, 2018, the Securities and Exchange Commission charged Theranos, Holmes, and Balwani with conducting an elaborate, years-long fraud. To resolve the agency's civil charges, Holmes was forced to relinquish her voting control over the company, give back a big chunk of her stock, and pay a $500,000 penalty. She also agreed to be barred from being an officer or director in a public company for 10 years. Unable to reach a settlement with Balwani, the SEC sued him in federal court in California. In the meantime, the criminal investigation continued to gather steam. As of this writing, criminal indictments of both Holmes and Balwani on charges of lying to investors and federal officials seem a distinct possibility. The term vaporware was coined in the early 1980s to describe new computer software or hardware that was announced with great fanfare only to take years to materialize, if it did at all. It was a reflection of the computer industry's tendency to play it fast and loose when it came to marketing. Microsoft, Apple, and Oracle were all accused of engaging in the practice at one point or another. Such overpromising became a defining feature of Silicon Valley. The harm done to consumers was minor, measured in frustration and deflated expectations. By positioning Theranos as a tech company in the heart of the valley, Holmes channeled this fake-it-until-you-make-it culture, and she went to extreme lengths to hide the fakery. Many companies in Silicon Valley make their employees sign non-disclosure agreements, but at Theranos, the obsession with secrecy reached a whole different level. Employees were prohibited from putting Theranos on their LinkedIn profiles. Instead, they were told to write that they worked for a private biotechnology company. Some former employees received cease and desist letters from Theranos lawyers for posting descriptions of their jobs at the company that were deemed too detailed. Balwani routinely monitored employees' emails and internet browser history. He also prohibited the use of Google Chrome on the theory that Google could use the web browser to spy on Theranos' R&D. Employees who worked at the office complex in Newark were discouraged from using the gym there because it might lead them to mingle with workers from other companies that leased space at the site. In the part of the clinical lab dubbed Normandy, partitions were erected around the Edisons so that Siemens technicians wouldn't be able to see them when they came to service the German manufacturer's machines. The partitions turned the room into a maze and blocked egress. The lab's windows were tinted, which made it nearly impossible to see in from the outside, but the company still taped sheets of opaque plastic to the inside. The doors to the corridor that led to the lab rooms, and the lab rooms themselves, were equipped with fingerprint scanners. If more than one person entered at a time, sensors set off an alarm and activated a camera that sent a photo to the security desk. As for surveillance cameras, they were everywhere. They were the kind with dark blue dome covers that kept you guessing about which way the lens was directed. All of this was ostensibly to protect trade secrets, but it's now clear that it was also a way for Holmes to cover up her lies about the state of Theranos' technology. Hyping your product to get funding while concealing your true progress and hoping that reality will eventually catch up to the hype continues to be tolerated in the tech industry. But it's crucial to bear in mind that Theranos wasn't a tech company in the traditional sense. It was first and foremost a healthcare company. Its product wasn't software, but a medical device that analyzed people's blood. As Holmes herself liked to point out in media interviews and public appearances at the height of her fame, doctors base 70% of their treatment decisions on lab results. They rely on lab equipment to work as advertised. Otherwise, patient health is jeopardized. So how was Holmes able to rationalize gambling with people's lives? One school of thought is that she became captive to Balwani's nefarious influence. Under this theory, Balwani was Holmes' Svengali and molded her, the innocent ingenue with big dreams, into the precocious young female startup founder that the Valley craved and that he was too old, too male, and too Indian to play himself. There's no question that Balwani was a bad influence, but to place all the blame on his shoulders is not only too convenient, it's inaccurate. Employees who saw the two interact up close describe a partnership in which Holmes, even if she was almost 20 years younger, had the last say. Moreover, Balwani didn't join Theranos until late 2009. By then, Holmes had already been misleading pharmaceutical companies for years about the readiness of her technology. And with actions that ranged from blackmailing her chief financial officer to suing ex-employees, she had displayed a pattern of ruthlessness at odds with the portrait of a well-intentioned young woman manipulated by an older man. Holmes knew exactly what she was doing, and she was firmly in control. When one former employee interviewed for a job at Theranos in the summer of 2011, he asked Holmes about the role of the company's board. She took offense at the question. "The board is just a placeholder," he recalls her saying. "I make all the decisions here." Her annoyance was so palpable that he thought he'd blown the interview. 2 years later, Holmes made sure that the board would never be more than a placeholder. In December 2013, she forced through a resolution that assigned 100 votes to every share she owned, giving her 99.7% of the voting rights. From that point on, the Theranos board couldn't even reach a quorum without Holmes. When he was later questioned about board deliberations in a deposition, George Shultz said, "We never took any votes at Theranos. It was pointless. Elizabeth was going to decide whatever she decided." This helps explain why the board never hired a law firm to conduct an independent investigation of what happened. At a publicly traded company, such an investigation would have been commissioned within days or weeks of the first media revelations. But at Theranos, nothing could be decided or done without Holmes's assent. If anything, it was Holmes who was the manipulator. One after another, she wrapped people around her finger and persuaded them to do her bidding. The first to fall under her spell was Channing Robertson, the Stanford engineering professor whose reputation helped give her credibility when she was just a teenager. Then there was Donald L. Lucas, the aging venture capitalist whose backing and connections enabled her to keep raising money. Dr. J. and Wade Miquelon at Walgreens and Safeway CEO Steve Bird were next, followed by James Mattis, George Shultz, and Henry Kissinger. Mattis's entanglement with Theranos proved no obstacle to his being confirmed as President Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense. David Boyce and Rupert Murdoch complete the list, though I've left out many others who were bewitched by Holmes's mixture of charm, intelligence, and charisma. A sociopath is often described as someone with little or no conscience. I'll leave it to the psychologists to decide whether Holmes fits the clinical profile, but there's no question that her moral compass was badly askew. I'm fairly certain she didn't initially set out to defraud investors and put patients in harm's way when she dropped out of Stanford 15 years ago. By all accounts, she had a vision that she genuinely believed in and threw herself into realizing. But in her all-consuming quest to be the second coming of Steve Jobs amid the gold rush of the unicorn boom, there came a point when she stopped listening to sound advice and began to cut corners. Her ambition was voracious, and it brooked no interference. If there was collateral damage on her way to riches and fame, so be it. This is Will Dameron. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup by John Carreyrou. This program was directed by Tony Huds. Executive producer, Sarah Jaffe. Text copyright 2018 by John Carreyrou. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.